I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. What we call our American conversation with global attitude picks up here on the south coast of Jamaica at the Calabash Literary Festival with poets and writers from every corner of the world. But the overpowering voice in the fiction readings belongs to a native son from down the road in Kingston. Marlon James, in his second novel, The Book of Night Women, has conjured a blood-curdling conspiracy of female slaves in Jamaica in the year 1800. Their mission is to burn, kill, and destroy a merciless slave plantation with the same rapacious cruelty that the British masters have used to run it. It's not so much a historical novel as a very modern elaboration of violence that strips the souls of people. You feel you're not just reading it, you're becoming a witness to brutality that compromises everybody, but also to love where you least expected it. There's a writer here, Marlon James, with a book and an inventive language that's very much for us and our world. Marlon James, you've been the big new voice for me here at Calabash 09, this voice people call Faulknerian, Toni Morrisonian, this voice out of a slave narrative from early 19th century Jamaica, this voice that's uncanny, I must say, in channeling a woman in slavery, in brutal slavery in the early 19th century. Maybe we should hear it first. Read as you will.
Sure. Well, one of the most forbidden things in slavery is, even with theft and rape and so on, perhaps the unforgivable thing was to know how to read. That was the one thing where sometimes you're killed almost instantly. It was just something that was absolutely forbidden. It was an instrument of control, illiteracy. We could say it still is. But the Book of Night Women is a bunch of women who, slave women, who are secretly plotting a rebellion. But once they're recruited, the first thing that they learn is to read. You know, that's sort of an instrument of power. So I'm going to read one of the scenes where Homer, who is a head slave, a woman, introduces Lilith, who is this rebellious young slave, about reading. And it starts, Homer go down the cellar one night and wake Lilith up. Homer by her close, and Lilith don't like it. Homer pull out something from her apron. You know what this be, child? Me didn't bond band call is book, they call it. You don't say. Is when since you lay eye upon book, Tantalus did, but not to touch. Touch it then. Homer hand the book to Lilith, and she take it in her fingers. Lilith expects something like a dress or a jewel box that easy to break like any other Bakra thing. The book hard and soft at once. The cover, when she run her fingers over it, feel like linen or Osnaburg. But the book also hard like wood and thick. The book red like wine or blood. She never feel or smell anything like that ever. A scent like oil, or mayhaps white man armpit, or dust, or something else. All of them smelling something awful apart, but together make the most wonderfulest thing. Lilith close her eye and breathe in a smell like tobacco. Even better when you open it, Homer say. Okay. Well, since then, Lilith has gone through, let's call it tons of tragedy and heartbreak and just shocking violence, abuse directed on her. And she's also been banished to another estate where she's pretty much alone. And, searching through the new estate's library, she comes across a whole series of books, but then she finds Joseph Andrews. And it's almost as if finding an old friend. Joseph Andrews becomes, the novel becomes the only sort of solace she has, the only sort of familiarity, certainly the only thing that brings fun or even some sort of lightness in such a heavy, oppressive world. But she's starting to see that the world she's reading in fiction and the world that she's experiencing as a slave are totally different. They have nothing to do with each other. The one represents like the very best of gentlemen, and she's surrounded by the very worst of people. And that is creating a crisis in her head. And in this scene, it's a scene before something really, really violent happens, is when she kind of loses faith in literature, in a book like Joseph Andrews, because she starts to realize that when you're a slave, when you're a black in that time, that type of fiction can lie to you as to what that world is. So it opens with the new mistress, Miss Isabel, waking her up by whipping her in the face. It says, Miss Isabel step over Lilith and wake her up by slapping her forehead with a horsewhip. It's 6 o'clock, you indolent bitch, Miss Isabel say. Lucky for you, my horse is the only animal getting thrashed today. I shall be back by the afternoon. Tell that to my stepmother when she asks. Yes, Miss Isabel, me commencing breakfast right now, Mrs., Lilith say. But Miss Isabel gone through the door already. A horse whinny and then gallop off. Lilith rub her eye and get up. She make one step and feel Joseph Andrews under her foot. Lilith shudder. Surely, if Miss Isabel did see the book, Lilith would be halfway up a tree to be whipped by now. Lilith grab the book and hide it in the cupboard. Joseph want her to look at him, to laugh like a white woman who have the right to. But she not a white woman. She not Lady Booby or Betty, the servant. This is not England. And there be no man in the colony like Joseph Andrews or him very dear friend, Mr. Abraham Adams. And even if there be white men of such quality, there be only so for white people. There be no love for the nigger. Lilith cup some water and splash in her face. The coldness wake her up. She check the stove if any piece of wood left to start a new fire. As soon as the fire catch, she would go out and commence milking the milk cows and setting loose the fed cows so they can graze. The chickens wake up late. Even the sun haul herself out this morning like she don't want to come out to work. In 2 hours, the mistress wake up and the picnic is going to start to make all sort of noise.
Marlon James, I want to know where this voice comes from. Where the female perspective? Where the connection with English tradition? Where the connection with slave narratives?
Wow. Where did the voice come from? I heard Chinua Achebe says, Chinua Achebe always starts a novel with an issue first. And I was really, that struck me because that never happens to me. It's always characters. They just show up one day and won't leave. And Lilith was sort of the hardest because it really didn't occur to me to write a slave novel at all. It started out with a novel set in that time, but it was a novel about a bank robber who is somehow connected to Lilith in some way, related. And I started that book in the third person, in very much Jane Austen kind of English, which I get a no to write. And I ran into a dead end with that story. But the final scene was a magistrate interviewing people who may have seen the robbery. And one was Lilith. And it was supposed to be just a small chapter to get me out of it to the next thing. And I was actually writing in dialect just as a break. And I wrote a scene where somebody's telling the whole story of this Lilith character. And what was supposed to be 5 pages turned into 600 pages. And because I have a very sort of very sloppy attitude to writing, which is even if you started writing A and B seems to be more interesting, just go with B. And that's what happened. It just went on and on. I suddenly became very fascinated by this woman. What is her story? Like, I usually start at the end of a story and say, this person is in this state. Well, how did she get there? And it was very fascinating thinking, if she's in this room in 1820 and she's 40, you know, that means when she was 20, may have been 17-something. How did she get here? How come she's not dead? How come she was, you know... To get this far, you have to be a survivor of something. And what did she survive? And the novel actually ended up almost being developed in reverse.
I'm reading it from the beginning. I'm only 300 pages in. But she is the green-eyed child of a woman who died in childbirth. Mm-hmm. We don't know who her father is. She's tough. Shall we say, everything you read so far is... wildly pretty compared to most of this book.
Right.
Gang rape and beatings of every kind, murder, lust. It's an awful story in certain ways, and yet Lilith survives and learns and becomes the center of the conspiracy. She also falls in love.
Yes.
This is the transgressive piece, shall we say. She falls in love with a rough, mean overseer named Robert Quinn, an Irishman and a white man, of course. Take us through that. What's going on?
What's going on is just the complexity of slavery. The thing about slavery, even if you look at it as pure history, is that nobody gets to make it black and white, not the children of slave owners or the children of slaves. There are quite a few slaves who loved slavery. Not every white person was for the slavery institution. The abolitionist movement began in London. But to come back to the question, it was just such a complex and such a weird time, especially for an Irishman and a slave. The Irish were the first real slaves here. They were indentured. Interestingly, in the book, what I thought was interesting researching it, that even though Lilith is a slave, she's not the one who experiences prejudice. The Irishman does. There are certain a hotel in Spanish Town she could stay at because she's a property of someone of importance. An Irishman could never stay at a hotel where the gentry hang out. You know, they'll always say, well, at least a slave is worth something, an Irishman is worth nothing. So they're actually the ones suffering the bigotry, even though they're not the slaves. So it creates these weird dynamics. If I'm Irish, then I think, well, I'm persecuted too. And there's, when you come to it, there's a scene in the book where Robert Quinn actually assumes that he understands Lilith's burden because he's prejudiced against. And he doesn't realize it's still a totally different thing. He's not being whipped. He's not being punished. But even in such a weird, it happened more than people want to admit. It's not just a Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, Monticello thing. It's something that happened regularly here. They'd call him a cher ami, which means they're the head slave and the master's favorite. Some of these slaves reach to the point where they become the de facto head of the plantations and even whip slaves. So see, it's just these sort of very complex relationships. It's this whole, you know, you don't legislate what things go bump in the night, really. And those things happen. Love happened or some semblance of it.
Is Lilith and Robert Quinn a semblance or the real thing?
I don't know. And I don't think they do either. What's more important is I don't think they do. Because I left the question open-ended because they're also asking it. You know, Lilith certainly asks it all the time. Really, how far can this go? You know, I'm a slave. He is the overseer. Just the whole dynamics of this. If we have a baby, who is the baby free or a slave? You know, she's never going to get married to him. They never at any point say the word love, but they act very sort of proprietary, you know, like as if they belong to each other. It's this great thing that's always unsaid, and it's such a common story in literature and in life. You know, what's his name? It's the Senator Strom Thurmond, who has his black daughter, who he never spoke about, even though there was clearly some affection going on, but. It's unspoken because they don't know how to speak about it. It's such a brutal world. And, you know, it's such a... You wake up as a slave. As a slave, you don't think you have a right to expect tomorrow. Any day, literally any day you could die. Any day is your last. Things like love or family or children or any sort of bond, something that builds a bond or relationship, you're too afraid to explore, and you're too afraid to say that this may happen or so on. And that's what I think to an extent happens with Lilith and Quinn. They just, especially Lilith, just it's as if by naming it, it will go. So it's just you through the day to day things. So love becomes something like making sure he has his dinner ready. She has his dinner ready. Love is him, you know, exclaiming about his cooking and teaching her how to dance, you know, which, you know, something that you'd do teach a lady. So it becomes gestures. It becomes all these actions. It never becomes words. Because nobody, it's slavery. It's You know, it's, the stakes are too high for an Irishman to say, I want to marry this black woman. The stakes are too high for a slave to go, well, I'm his mistress, so I don't have to be a slave anymore. It's too high. So it becomes unspoken. And to take it out of the novel, that type of unspoken interracial relationships went straight into the late 20th century. Even now, there are rich families in Jamaica, rich white families in Jamaica with second families, you know, sometimes not far away from the first. Yeah, it's still there.
Marlon James, two questions in my mind. Where did you go digging in yourself for this story? And then what is the modern world to which you're presenting this story? What should we moderns make of this novel?
Where did I dig for this story?
What moved you to write it? What made you a writer?
What made me a writer? God, that's a bigger question. You know, even after I wrote my first book, I didn't think I was a writer. I never published that book. It was actually awful. But I, you know, I read somewhere after it happened to me. So I said what it was, and after it happened to me, I could recognize it, so I can say what it was now, but I didn't know it then. I was given permission to write. I didn't really realize that that was what it was back then until I read an interview with Marquez, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and he's talking about how Kafka gave him permission to write. How he read The Penal Colony and The Metamorphosis and was just so appalled by it. But he couldn't understand who gave this man the right to write like this and to tell those kinds of stories. And he realized that by reading this, Kafka gave him permission to write what he wrote. Because he was a writer before, but he wasn't a novelist until he read Kafka. And for me, that was Salman Rushdie's Shame. Because I had written a novel before, and it was very much in a sort of realist tradition, which you can't help. Growing up in Jamaica, the bulk of the literature books you read are Victorian. You know, you think Dickens is up here. You think Dickens is alive or something. But I read Shame, and I remember before I even read the Marcus thing, being so appalled by it. And I mean, thinking it was brilliant, but I remember almost saying, "How dare he write this?" You know, things like killing the element of surprise in a novel, saying character A who shall die on page 20. And you flip to page 20 and he really does die. It's like, but this goes against everything I've learned about literature, about plotting, about the art of the element of surprise, about what you can and cannot do about a character, whether you should enter the novel or not. And by reading Shame, Arias, I could then do things which I thought I wasn't allowed to do, including things like flying women and all of that, which is in my first novel, but also revisiting something like slavery and writing it from a different perspective. I wasn't interested in writing a historical novel, and I don't think I wrote one. It's very much a feminist perspective in a lot of the ways that my first novel was kind of a queer perspective. The idea, and I got that perspective from talking to an African poet who, and this is when the book was still the British command investigating something, and she told me about African society and how matriarchal it was, how woman-led, and how women decided when to plant, and a woman, and the line of succession was through the woman, the oldest sister. And I thought, well, what if a bunch of women, some from Africa, some born in the colonies, created this power circle like how it was in Africa, but nobody knew but them? That to the point, for good or bad, where they could be organizing women to read and nobody knows. But it could also be killing rivals and nobody knows. You know, because the good can't come without the bad, the power and the abuse of power. And what if this whole sort of league of night women existed and nobody knew about it? And I just became more and more fascinated with the idea. I'm really, as I said, driven by ideas. I wasn't trying to, you know, strike my blow for the slavery novel or you know, attack Whitey. It was always just, just running across characters and just being really fascinated by by where they're going. Even the whole idea of rebellion, people always ask, did such a thing happen? And I was like, no, but it's a fantastic idea, isn't it? And that's what, I'm driven by, more so than the history. Some reviewers, mostly Jamaican, point out that some of the songs that the slaves sing are actually 20th century songs. I was like, yeah. Some of the words are made up, because I was more interested in just the story as opposed to getting those things off my chest. But to tie it back to your question, which I'm answering in a very long-winded way, it was still, the result of a lot of research. It's a result of growing up in a slavery economy. If you drive to certain parts of Jamaica, you'll still see miles of sugarcane. If you look hard enough, you'll still see the great house in the background. Some of my friends' families own slaves. My family, if we go way back, we don't end up in Africa. We end up in Ireland and Scotland. Mm. Yeah, my father's side of the family are Pringles from Scotland. Mm. My mother's side are Dillons from Ireland.
People.
Yeah, so it's part of it is that slavery is just part of the natural narrative of every person in the British West Indies, in the colonies. You can't escape it. It's right there. It's in its room. It's everywhere. So part of it is that. But there was still a lot of research and just going back to these actual voices, reading slave narratives, the story of Mary Prince, incidents in the life of a slave girl, Equiana's travels. But even more than that, because I knew a lot of that already, reading master narratives, like the Thistlewood Diaries, reading simple things like ship logs. Most of these still exist. And in some ways, they can be even more devastating because they're so written without any emotion. It's, day one, 400 slaves. Day seven, 392. Six jumped. And that's it. And some of it's, and then what that does is that it then fires up my desire to write. Because I'm like, but what about, they can't just be a number. What's their story? And it just, that's what happens. The more I was researching, the more I read, is the more stuff to write about. And this, which I at no point intended to be a long novel, became a very long novel. Yeah.
Second question is, what is the contemporary, 2009, what is the contemporary 21st century narrative to which you're contributing this insight? The narrative of globalization, of terrible division of peoples and classes and fed and unfed, and at the same time a transnational president of the United States who's looking for another way. Where do you come into today's world, the world you teach in?
That's a good question, because one of the concerns I think some of one or two critics is, in such a forward-looking time, why are you writing a backward-looking novel? Black is the new president, and it's we're post-racial now. Why are you writing this sort of slavery screed? Aren't we past that? And there are a lot of answers to that, and not just the very typical one, which anybody who writes about slavery would say that, well, you need to know your history and so on. It's not that at all, because I wasn't writing a historical novel. The dialogue, I think there are many ways in which this novel, I hope, is in dialogue with the present. The first is ownership of language. That the story is old, but the idea of telling a story in the voices of the people who went through it is still a pretty new thing. There's Beloved, but there's also Uncle Tom's Cabin. Most of the idea of whether it's a slave story or a story about urban poverty or so on, in the voice of the people who experience it, is still pretty new. And it's still pretty radical when you look at the British West Indies and the colonies. The first publisher to see this was a British publisher who turned it down. And her request to me was, would I rethink rewriting this in the third person in standard English? And then they'll print it. And what struck me there is that even in 2000, this was 2007, that the stories, people still refuse to have stories being told by the people who experienced it. So I think in that sense, that's important, and that's a very different thing and a very new thing, that it's not just a slave is telling a story, but telling it in the language that breaks standard English, that accepts lyricism as part of it, that breaks words here, that joins words there, that it's a slavery novel, but it's something that's acknowledging the dynamism of just spoken dialect English and owning it, which again is still a new thing. Even in Jamaica now, some of my biggest critics about the language are Jamaicans, because to them it's broken English, implying that something needs to be fixed. So I think that itself, not necessarily the narrative, the content, but the form, I think is very much in a sort of dialogue. I also think, to take it outside of that, we're under this impression that slavery is no longer going on. And it never stopped. Yeah, and it may be changed in certain ways. American prisoners who get thrust on work gangs, I mean, black Americans, even after Reconstruction, got thrust on work gangs. That was slavery itself. There's a great book called Slavery by Another Name, which goes into that.
Oh, how I love that book.
Yeah.
And it won a Pulitzer Prize, praise God.
Yeah.
Douglas Blackman's Slavery by Another Name.
Right. What happens, still happens in Haiti. If I owe you $200 and I die, that means my son has to work until that gets paid off. And if he dies, his son has to work until that gets paid off. It's still slavery. And it's still people being forced to labor against their will is still here. Abuse is still here. And also, you know, I said it before. I mean, I was very much interested in writing a feminist perspective kind of novel. And the whole idea, not just of women, but not being superficial about it. It's women coming together to empower themselves. That's nice. But it's also women coming together to destroy and kill. So you're trying to create something for a destructive purpose. What's going to happen? I didn't want to let anybody off the hook in this book, including the victims. And I think that also was something that had to be said. It's too easy. I said if blacks accuse whites of denial, then blacks could accuse themselves of myth making. That it was this all oppressed blacks and oppressive whites, which is why a book like The Known World was kind of so painful for some people to read, about slaves owning slaves. That's a fact. It happened. Slaves who fight on the side of the masters during a rebellion. I wanted to get out. I knew I could have written a very black and white story and probably still be praised for it. Largely also sometimes, and it must be said, out of guilt. I know. I could have just easily written horrendous white masters beating poor victim slaves and get away with it. But then that's intellectually dishonest. I think the more humane thing, but also the more, I'm struck as a better way, a dialogue that's more in conversation with what's going on now is one that recognizes all the ambiguities, and that even such a dark world is still pretty gray.
Touré wrote an interesting review in the New York Times of Colson Whitehead's new book, Sag Harbor, and it was all about shades of black, being black in different ways. Mm-hmm. Is Obama black enough? Is he too black? Where do you stand in relation to a project to complicate and ironize or see new ways of seeing black and white?
Well, I read that review and I was struck by it in two different ways. Because like Colson and like Touré, Jamaicans like me have been growing up in that world all along. You know,
interesting.
I read that, and I'm not talking about my writing, I'm talking about myself. I read that, and I was like, what took you so long? We've been living that way and getting flack from black Americans for years. You know, is
what does the flack sound like?
Well, there's always been a sort of a black American-Jamaican tension. It's sort of erased now, but
you've heard that phrase, worst Indians.
Yeah. I'm old enough to remember it. You know, if say a Jamaican married a white woman, I go, well, of course, it's a Jamaican. You know, we would think they're too lazy. But the idea, when yesterday I was wearing a Morrissey t-shirt from the band The Smiths, if I were to wear that in New York in the 80s, you know, they'd be calling me Wigger or for one of a, you know, and so on. Just, why am I trying to be white? So the idea that review was talking about black kids who break that, who never were part of that stereotype, and sort of in some ways get flack from both sides. You know, I remember going to rock concerts and the black kids thinking you're trying to be white, and the white kids thinking you're weird. Why are you, you know? And even when I sit down and give them the history about the blues, and how Howling Wolf and how Led Zeppelin had to go to Memphis Mini to get When the Levee Breaks, you know, it still sort of doesn't register. So in that sense, that review and the book is very much a wake-up call that there is no stereotypical black existence, even the ones that blacks themselves stereotype. Hmm. You don't have to like hip-hop to be black. I don't like reggae. You know?
Wow.
I don't. It's not that.
Is that a black thing or a Jamaican thing or country
just,
or what?
Is that, you know, it's for me, it's almost like a child hating his parents. It's because I grew up with it. I'm over familiar with it. I'll tell people I don't like it, but I don't like reggae, but I am reggae. You know, I don't think I have to like it anyway. I don't think I have to like all my family members, but it was this acknowledgement in the review and so on that you can't write one narrative of what's black and what's not black. And I remember, and I'm sure Touré does, and certainly Coulson does, when that existence was called not black. That said, though, that may be still the same generation who then go, but then why write a slavery novel? Why not write about growing up and watching Starsky and Hutch, and deciding Prince or Michael Jackson, and so on? And I have, you know, quite a few reasons for that. I think it's not just a matter of knowing a history so you don't repeat it. Is that you're headless without history. Mm. And I don't think it's being told enough. If I thought it was being told enough, I wouldn't have written the book. I don't think I'm on a mission, and I'm certainly not trying to write history. But I agree with Toni Morrison. She says she writes the books that she wanted to read but could never find. Mm. And I agree with that totally. I think there is certainly a rich tradition of slave narrative and so on, but it's still not enough. And even the most enduring and certainly the most lauded works about slavery tend to be about American slavery, like Beloved. And Caribbean slavery was just such a radically different thing. It was so violent, and when we were talking about this, about the violence, and you can't help but be almost hyper-violent when you're talking about West Indian slavery. And it's not even so much just the violence itself, but the uncertainty that makes it even more violent. You have all these slaves, unlike most of the slaves that came to the U.S. who were seasoned in countries like Jamaica before they were sent there. Most of these slaves came from Africa. They came from very proud, very, you know, they weren't like, you know, beaten into submission. They were very proud warriors, people from kingdoms who were just defeated in war. They were prisoners of a war of a sort, not necessarily victims who were waiting to be captured. And when you put that in a mix with people who come from Britain, mostly men, mostly young, they are being thrust into this world where anything goes. You know, it's bound to be explosive, and I think that story hasn't been told enough. In some ways, I think the Coulsons of this world make it easier for a book like this, because they're I like to think that he's busy getting the present tense written, so I can go back and shade in the past that's not.
One of the other striking things in this book is the sexual violence. Mm. I mean, it's just unceasing. When you read from this book, and you didn't spare the sexual parts, I found it fascinating. Jamaicans, by American standards, are very easy about sex. I mean, it is so much taken for granted. Mm. And it's out there, and people laugh about it. All kinds, except gay sex. Mm-hmm. And in your case, they recoiled at some point. They were feeding back some kind of, not so fast, we don't like this. We don't like the F word, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. What was that all about? Both as a historical thing, as a piece of your book, and as part of the drama of your own live reading.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer is actually in your question, is humor. When, because there's a reading before which goes into all sorts of different kinds of female anatomy. And you know, and I don't want to go into it, but it was very, very explicit. But it was almost slapstick humor. So when it's presented in an arena where they can laugh it off, or they can dismiss it as just subversive, perverted trash, you know, especially if it's homosexual, if they can, both are a matter of easy failing. One is, this is funny, even though it's a little raunchy, and this is just decadent perversion, so I can tune out and take my kids away from it. But, and you know, I almost empathize with it. Was I call them the Jamaican mothers for decency? You know, what when it's presented in a situation where one, it's in the language of dialect, and it must be said, even Jamaicans, when they hear dialect, they immediately think it's going to be slapstick humor. Because even we ourselves, Jamaicans, don't take our own dialect seriously. So when they're expecting this sort of humor, which they did get with the other sexually explicit reading, and that doesn't come, that this is violence visited on women, this is people talking about very harsh things in very harsh language, they're not going to be flower. It's slavery. The people who are teaching them to speak are also the people who are whipping them every night. Mm. They're being treated like, you know, animals and being called so. There is no tenderness. Mm. So, but, and I think that was profoundly disturbing. It's amazing. It's interesting, even now, a story about how slavery really was can be disturbing. And, so, you know, and also, you know, a brutal world is not going to have pretty language. That doesn't work. It's not going to happen that way. Because when you're in a world of abuse, you have, you know, the abuser also uses his tongue. It becomes almost an oral thing. I'm not saying I'm trying to just document series of abuse or so on. But I think that it's very hard for us to come to terms with how brutal history was. Mm-hmm. And I think we can accept brutality if it's told in a pretty way. But when that's also stripped bare, and you have nothing to deal with but the reality of this thing. You know, I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to say she was ravished twice because ravish is so poetic. No, she was raped. Yeah, it's you're not going to escape in language, and we're so used to, certainly in the Caribbean, escaping in language. So a poem is, lovely, dainty Spanish needle with your yellow flower and white, which sounds like it was written in 1812. That was written in the 1950s. Yeah, we still expect language to shield us from truth, I think. And it's very easy to do, especially when you grow up in a British-style system. That's how we learn. So I had to spend a good decade erasing that way of writing and speaking. But we haven't. So when it's presented in such a raw way, I mean, and they do get frightened, and they do get upset, and they were like screaming, there are children here. And you know, my response to that, well, one, they're going to learn the truth some one way or another, you know, and two, if you object to a sort of something that's been said at a reading, you can't have the art can't change for you. But you have the choice to accept or reject it.
One other small point, not so small maybe. There are Maroons in this story. Maroons having been given their freedom by the Brits, they really fought the Brits to a standstill, and they were given the freedom if they would police other black people.
Right.
I noticed when you're reading from the Book of Night Women that you called the Maroons they.
Yeah.
Is that still a sensitive word, sensitive name?
I was a lot more sensitive to that than to the words, the curse words. Because I think it's not taught enough. It's really hard. It's like if this were a story of the Holocaust, what do you do with the Jews who had to take them to the gas chamber? Are you going to call them all devils? Because they were forced too. What do you do with those? It's easy. Victim and perpetrator actually almost have it better than everybody else because they're black and white, good, evil. What do you do with everybody in the middle?
It's exactly the subject of Leslie Epstein's great novel, The King of the Jews, who presided over the liquidation of a ghetto.
But so when we come to the Maroons, again, it's come back to what I'm saying about myth-making. The story, but nostalgia works that way. We want to remember the nicer parts. The nicer parts is this is the even before Haiti, these were the group of blacks that brought the whites, brought the master class, the planter class to its knees, the British army, the British regiment to its knees. And we love that story. And we love that they went to such a standstill that the British signed a treaty. We love this. What we have a harder time accepting is that as part of the conditions, they then started hunting slaves. And they hunted slaves not just to fulfill the treaty. They hunted slaves because a female slave was £2. That's a lot of money. If you round up 10 slaves, you pretty much can feed your village for a year. Or whatever. It's a lot of money. It became a business, and they got very good at it. And what's also not said is even after slavery ended, up to 30, 40 years after slavery, if there was just a black person being an agitator like Paul Bogle, who was in a lot of ways sort of a trade unionist 100 years before his time, but they also rounded up those guys. If it was somebody who just wrote like terrible letters to the editor and they started to look at him as a seditionist and he ran away, they would hunt that person down too. So it's not just that they're hunting down slaves, they're hunting down the early progenitors, the early defenders of free speech, people who would have considered an embarrassment to the crown. So it's not like it just was a slavery episode that we can just close the book. It went on after that. And we are now it's very difficult to process that. Where do you place them? Are they heroes or are they villains? And it's something that's still going on. It's something that's going on even as I read it, because I'm going, this is St. Elizabeth, there are probably Maroons in the audience.
But so why do you leave the word Maroons out of your reading?
I think, you know, I started with it, and then I stopped. And I switched to they, because I didn't know. And I didn't want to, I am all for somebody coming up after reading and confronting me. When they do it during the reading, like the women who shouted out, their children here, you really have to make a decision. What are you going to turn it into, a sort of a sideshow where you, all right, we're going to reckon with history right now? Because then that becomes a conversation between only two people. And it was, it may have been a compromise, but to me it was, you know, I have to keep this a story being told to as many people as possible. Hopefully they'll buy the book and see how it really went. But instead of it being, I am here to have you confront your own histories. And that is very uncomfortable, and it would have become that. And I don't want to be that. So that's why I made that decision there. I don't want to necessarily take on the burden of, Mister, I'm going to tell you all what slavery was all about. Here, you need to come to terms with your history, and I'm going to do it. You know, I'm not, that's not my job.
Marlon James, I come to Jamaica so gratefully for perspective on the States, perspective on the whole world. You teach in the Middle West, at McAllister, in the Twin Cities. What sort of perspective do you get from coming home to Jamaica on the whole game, including, you know, the age of Obama and the way the world is going?
I remember Pankaj Mishra wrote an article, and he was talking about the non-American post 9/11, and he says the non-American is in a state of fundamental instability, and I still think that's true. Even in the age of Obama, I think we're certainly hoping for the best. We certainly think the best candidate won. God knows a candidate who reads is a major thing.
He reads Joseph O'Neill, Netherland.
Yeah, which probably is the best 9/11 novel so far. But it's too easy to be cynical, I think, and certainly writing about the terrible things done in the past. But I think the combination of accepting the truths about the bad and good in the past, but working towards the best we can do in the present and the future, I think that's a mix that you have to go for. It's the past that's going to sober you and make sure you don't make those mistakes again. So I think they all sort of work together. I teach in Minneapolis, and it's, you know, I'm surrounded by students who are fiercely intelligent, but not necessarily aware of the world they're in. And me, as an outsider, can do two things. I can tell them about the world that they're not seeing, and also tell them their world from a set that they can't look at. They can't look at their own world from the perspective of an outsider. And even outsider is a term that's pretty much now dead. You know, you have a half Kenyan Hawaiian president who... the great thing about the inauguration was all these countries in the world claiming him. You know, so in Africa he's the Kenyan president, in Hawaii he's a Hawaiian president. I think it's fantastic. You know, in Chicago he's the first Chicagoan to be a president, and it's fantastic because some Pico Iyer was saying yesterday in his talk, you know, those boundaries where you're from is almost irrelevant. It really is where you're at. And it's certainly for me as a Jamaican, not living in Jamaica, but still writing about Jamaica, and trying not to fall into the trap that happens when you no longer live in your country of origin, where you just get stuck with nostalgia, you know. And I think that's actually part of the reason why the reading yesterday became sort of controversial, because they're expecting two things. One, they're expecting slapstick because of the dialect, but they're also expecting nostalgia because they don't live here. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of nostalgia at all. Knowing history is important, but knowing what went right, what went wrong, and moving from that, which is something I think nostalgia can't teach you. But I think certainly in this age, there is such a hope and expectation, sometimes unrealistic. I think people need to remember that Obama is a politician. So they said, well, I'm so disappointed. I mean, what, you're disappointed in him playing politics? What do you think he was, a nun? You know, it's politics. I think we have no reason to doubt, though, that we have a president who has our best interests at heart. Not to the point where he thinks he's better than us and he can do whatever he wants, but to the point that, you know... that America, that the United States can take its place as a global citizen, and that people can look at an American ideal as something. You don't necessarily have to adopt it whole hog, because that's America's ideal, it's not yours. But to just learn from you know, the example, the Caribbean literature movement could never have happened without the Harlem Renaissance. But then again, the Harlem Renaissance could never have happened without people like Claude McKibb. What I'm saying is there is so much that we have to learn from each other. And one of the things I think that is great about this administration and the way people are thinking is that I think we're thinking that again, that we can learn from each other.
Chris Abani said at Calabash last year, without Jamaica, there's no Nigeria either. So goes around, comes around.
Yeah. He's right, you know, and without Nigeria, there would be no post-colonial lit. You know, the concept wouldn't have even occurred to us if it was for Achebe and Ngugi, you know, and you know, it would just, the whole idea of taking charge of your own letters, it just would never have happened. So it is this sort of cross this cross-pollination, this cross-dialogue, which sometimes we forget that we're always having.
Marlon James, that'll do for a bumper sticker for the whole weekend, that it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. It's a huge pleasure to read you, to meet you, to gab with you, and I can't thank you enough. Marlon James of the Book of Night Women, a real privilege. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Marlon James about his new novel titled The Book of Night Women. Feedback yourself on history's living dialogue with our present. Feedback on blackness, whiteness, villainy, and victimhood, and the places in between at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon, with more talk to come from Calabash and Jamaica. Wherever you're from, wherever you're at, thank you for joining us.